You're listening to Raising Your Antenna with host Keith Sackheim.
Welcome to Raising Your Antenna. I am your host, Keith Sackheim, and today we are making history as we are venturing over the pond and connecting with our first international guest, James Nettleton, a principal with InMotion Ventures, a mobility and transportation technology-focused fund that is funded by Jaguar Land Rover. James is joining us from London, and to make him feel comfortable, I'm sitting in our studios in northern New Jersey on a dreary, damp, London-like day. England and the U.S. have what Winston Churchill dubbed during the dark days of World War II, the special relationship. And I guess as we move forward into this brave new world of autonomous vehicles, ride-sharing, and car fleet membership, the U.S. and U.K. are once again exhibiting a special relationship, this time reflected in technology development and financial investment. With that being said, and the weight of podcast history on your shoulders, James, welcome to the anthill, and please introduce yourself to our listeners.
Hi, wow. Honor. I didn't realize that was your first British podcastee, so quite the honor. So as you said, James Nettleton, principal at InMotion Ventures. We're a fund investing in early stage companies, typically seed stage through Series B, typically from kind of $500,000 to $5 million kind of pound checks in all things transport and mobility. There's a team, the investment team anyway, here in London. It's six of us, but we invest all over the world. And, you know, you mentioned the kind of special relationship between the UK and the US, and we certainly see that in the flows of venture capital both ways. About half of our portfolio is based in the US, and quite a lot of our UK companies have US investors. So we're certainly a transatlantic fund, if not a global fund.
Great. And InMotion Ventures, as I mentioned, is underwritten by Jaguar Land Rover. And, you know, James, a big portion of our listeners for this podcast are entrepreneurs and founders of companies, and many of them are looking for venture capital investment. So I thought maybe you could reflect a little bit about the difference between a venture capital firm that has a kind of one or two corporate investors or strategic investors versus maybe a more traditional fund that has a number of different types of LPs who maybe are not corporates or strategics.
Absolutely. Well, I think you've really got to think about those differences on a spectrum. So if all of one side of the spectrum, you've got your kind of pure play, multi-LP, institution-backed venture capital fund. And then right on the other side of the spectrum, you've got your highly strategic, maybe invest to acquire or invest to develop commercial partnerships fund backed by a single corporate. There's a really wide spectrum in between those two extremes. And I guess InMotion is somewhere in the middle. So when we do deals, we're doing deals with, I guess, kind of two key lenses. So the first and foremost is financial return. We have the same kind of expectations in that sense as any fund. And we're targeting kind of upper quartile returns as compared to the rest of the venture capital asset class. And then the other lens we're looking at is what can we and what can our funder, Jaguar Land Rover, learn from investing in and working with the companies in our portfolio. So for us, it's not about making commercial partnerships happen. It's not about investing to acquire. It's about what are the insights we gain into the world of transport and mobility by investing in, backing, and most importantly, supporting portfolio companies. And I think that can sound quite fluffy, but in the couple of years I've been investing in InMotion, I've seen just so many really tangible examples of where that's been the case. Whether it's us acting as a kind of think tank for the rest of the business by writing reports on rapidly kind of rising trends like micro mobility. We wrote a report for the business a couple of months ago on that. Or whether it's our portfolio companies providing services to Jaguar Land Rover customers or employees. Like one of our companies, Zelo, for instance, transports hundreds of people every day to and from Jaguar Land Rover work sites as a service provider. And that just never would have happened if they weren't in the portfolio and we hadn't built that relationship.
Okay, great. That makes sense. And I think that that's super helpful, again, for the founders and entrepreneurs who are listening to this podcast who are marketing right now to venture capital funds and trying to figure out, you know, which fund will fit their vision best. So thank you for that. You know, as I mentioned during the introduction, so James is our first guest from over the pond. And one of the things I'd love to talk about today, James, is, you know, the differences between U.S. And countries in Europe or Asia, for example, where the transportation challenges and therefore the needs and solutions to revamp transportation infrastructures are different. So one example is most European urban centers have far more comprehensive public transportation systems than the U.S. So that would mitigate some of the issues maybe around first and last mile, which again is one of the major reasons for some of the micro-mobility solutions we're seeing, like, you know, e-scooters and that type of stuff. There are other differences as well. So when car sharing companies launch or e-scooter companies want to parachute into a European city, what are the challenges that they have to contend with that are different perhaps from when they're launching in a San Francisco, Seattle, or New York?
Well, I think probably the single biggest challenge is the diversity of European cities within Europe. I had a kind of pitch type conversation with a high profile kind of US scooter sharing company in the last couple of months. And they were talking about how what their Europe strategy would be. And they were talking about setting up a Europe subsidiary and that they thought it was really important for that part of their business to be seen to have kind of European native leadership to help conversations with cities and to be seen as a kind of something that was homegrown. So which, and it's funny because coming from an American, I can completely see how that might make sense as a strategy. And the first thing I thought was, I just have never heard a Londoner or a Parisian or a Berliner refer to a company as being a Europe-based company. That's just not a concept that exists.
That's funny.
The diversity within the content is absolutely vast on I guess, in the context of mobility, on three or four different levels. So you've got huge regulatory differences. So if you look at the introduction of scooter sharing and bike sharing, you just couldn't see more different approaches between, say, Berlin, Paris, and London in like the last few months. So if we look at the introduction of scooter sharing, so in London right now, things are a little bit on pause, and it's not really because of the city so much. I think the sense we get is that micro-mobility will probably be welcomed, although in a measured and kind of sensible way by London. It's actually about the fact that the UK legislation currently doesn't allow small electric push scooters on the streets. And so without legislative change, you can't run one of those companies in the UK right now. So that's where we are in the UK. In Paris, we've seen the mayor welcome micro-mobility companies with open arms over the past few months. We've seen Bird launch with great success, and they're working really closely with mass transit operators to integrate them into existing transportation services. I was at Gare du Nord in Paris last week, and you saw big areas dedicated to scooters right outside the station, so you could get off your train, jump on a scooter, and go to work, and people were taking that up really quickly. And then in Berlin, which has really become a bit of a showground for new forms of mobility, you're seeing right now there's a lot of companies waiting and biding their time. They already have scooter sharing with companies like Emmy and Coop, and bike sharing with companies like Lime and Mobike. But everyone's waiting for the launch of a number of very well-funded European scooter companies because everyone's just waiting around for the city to publish its legislation. So we have this massive diversity, and anybody that tells you they have a Europe strategy really doesn't have one, because what you need is a city-by-city clinical strategy, close relationships with each city, and a really deep understanding of the dynamics. You know, London, as an example, has been a really tough nut to crack for car sharing for companies like Drive Now, which I think is called Reach Now in the States. And car sharing in London's been crazily complicated by the fact that we have 33 different boroughs, each of which controls their own parking and their own pavements and their own highways. In addition to TfL, and then in addition to national legislation. So you've got to navigate all of that complexity to deliver a citywide service, which people expect.
I guess maybe a lot of entrepreneurs were somewhat jaundiced by, you know, the Uber strategy of 7-8 years ago, which was, not really taking into account regulatory environments or, you know, cultural nuances of the cities that they would jump into. They would just go deploy and then figure out, you know, what they had to do to say I'm sorry, as opposed to asking permission. But I think what you're saying and makes a lot of sense is for and you know, the truth is, I don't know that the U.S. is that much different either. So, you know, the regulatory environment and type of municipal controls that you have maybe in New York City are very different than in San Francisco, than in Pittsburgh, than in Seattle, which is why I think in every country, certain cities are, in the case of Europe, you know, being the continent, but, you know, certain cities are more hospitable to these types of programs and innovation than other cities are. I guess companies have to take a much closer look at what this new world is, and it's going to be less the Uber paradigm in which you can just come in and start doing things, and it's going to have to be a little bit more planning working from the outset and partnering from the outset with local officials to make sure that, you know, the infrastructure is there and the cooperation is there to make sure that these cities are adopting technologies like these.
I completely agree, and that's 100% sunk in when it comes to the pitches we're seeing. So we've had 4 or 5 pitches in the last month alone from e-bike and e-scooter companies launching in Europe, and not one of them has led with a growth at all costs, take the market and then apologize for breaching legislation later. All of them have taken the approach of we will only launch with permission and we'll only launch when we're welcome to do so. And I don't think that's anything to do with the so much learning the lessons of Uber directly. They're completely different questions. And Uber was very much about employment rights, at least in Europe. And that was the real concern, as well as passenger safety. Whereas for e-scooters and e-bikes, it's much more about the impact they have on the streetscape and the impact they have on accessibility within the city. I think it's much more about the fact that Uber was a huge wake-up call, and that business model, rather, was a huge wake-up call for cities and regulators. And they really realized what happened when they were overtaken by technical innovation and when consumer demand created a huge pull, but maybe didn't account for some of the externalities created by mass adoption of the new service. And we really have seen in cities like London that the increase in private hire cars due to Uber has had a huge impact on congestion. And that's something that the city is now dealing with and looking to regulate more closely.
Yeah. Speaking of differences between the US and Europe, there was a recent KPMG study that I guess rated various countries for their preparedness for autonomous vehicle adoption. And that particular study found the Netherlands to be the country that's best prepared for the future of autonomous vehicles. The U.S. was third, United Kingdom was fifth. The study in particular gave the Netherlands high scores for excellent infrastructure, highly supportive government, and in general, I guess, enthusiastic adoption of electric vehicles, which a lot of people see as a barometer for future adoption of autonomous vehicles, although I'm not sure it's really the same thing. But anyway, but from your perspective, you know, what are the major variables that account for whether a country or a city is preparing itself for this paradigm shift? And then, and I guess you do because you've kind of mentioned a couple of examples already, but clearly you're taking these factors into account in your investment calculus.
Yeah, absolutely. So if we look at readiness in different places, so I think one of the debates we were having as a team earlier today was kind of what are the different factors? What can a city actually do to make itself more ready for autonomy? What does that mean in practice on a practical level? I think we decided that the first point was just self-education, actually. So it's incredibly hard to regulate something if you don't have a kind of foundational level of understanding, not necessarily a technical understanding, but just understanding what it means for a car to drive itself autonomy in the most basic way. And I think we have real challenges with that in part because the media often doesn't help with people's understanding of autonomy. We had a widely publicized article last week in the UK, which was talking about how American autonomous vehicle companies might struggle to launch in the UK because they can't recognize the weird and wonderful vehicles we have, like the London bus and the London taxi. Now, anybody with even the first 1% of understanding of how autonomy works would tell you how crazy that is.
Right.
No robust AV stack is going to see a massive bus cruising down the street. And because it can't classify it specifically as a bus, just ignore its presence and drive straight into a wall. That just isn't the reality. But
maybe the issue is that some of these technologies can't pick up the way the British spell the word Q, maybe, or something.
Yeah, well, quite right. So so I think, the first thing is understanding, right? And I think there are responsibilities both on the side of the industry and on the side of the regulator to open up a dialogue to help kind of, create a common understanding of what autonomy actually means on a technical level and on a practical level. So that's one, is kind of self-regulation. I think two, and this is very easy to say and quite hard to achieve, but is when regulating, to just regulate with speed and with clarity. And clarity is probably the most important thing there. I think most AV companies that are operating today would tell you that they'd much rather have a clear set of obstacles that they have to overcome to be able to operate in a city than lack of clarity and having to guess where they act and where they can't. So even if the starting point is just kind of outright outlawing everything, but with a clear path towards introducing autonomous testing and autonomous trials on specific routes and specific areas and under specific conditions, that's a much better place to be if clarity is there and if regulations are put in place pretty early in the development cycle. That makes things a lot easier and it really makes the city more ready.
Yeah, that makes sense. I guess for that to happen, though, there has to be, I would think, some pretty strong cooperation between, the private sector and government, because this is something that is so new. Government is in most areas is kind of stuck in legacy systems. And so the people in government need, I think, the expertise of people in the private sector in order for them to understand what it is that they're regulating in the first place. They don't know what they don't know, I guess. And I think a lot of the confusion probably stems from that.
Absolutely. But I think the great thing is that these forums are starting to exist particularly in major cities around the world. Me alone, I've been to a dozen or so roundtables with senior officials in London, city level, national level. We discuss and debate all of these things. And around the table, you have representatives from leading mobility companies in London, whether it's Uber or Citymapper or autonomous vehicle companies like 5AI. And those dialogues are starting to happen, not least because certainly in the UK, the government has actually been quite a key funder, whether it's through universities, but also through city trials of the development of autonomous vehicle technology. So I think we do see some pretty strong dialogue, but there always needs to be more, and most importantly, that needs to be back into the people that are writing the legislation and drawing up the regulation. I think the biggest challenge is perhaps for slightly smaller, less well-resourced cities. There's a lot of things. One of the reasons me and my whole team travel a lot all around the world is that if you sat in London in a lot of ways, you could be forgiven for thinking that we live in this kind of transportation utopia where everything just works and I just tap my credit card on my phone with Apple Pay on a bus or on the tube or wherever I go and payments just happen seamlessly and I just travel throughout the city with kind of almost no barriers and no cash changing hands. And that's not actually how most of the world works. I think in smaller towns and in smaller cities, it's a lot harder to get that dialogue going because you're further away from the innovation, you're further away from where the companies are headquartered. And you also, frankly, just have less resources to spend on these types of projects.
Yeah, that's a great point. I think that all of us that live in kind of the big city bubbles, San Francisco, New York, London, Berlin, what have you, it's helpful to have that perspective, especially when rolling out some of these things into other areas. James, if we can shift focus a little bit, we mentioned before that InMotion is principally funded by Jaguar Land Rover. And I know you don't speak for Jaguar Land Rover. You speak for yourself and for the fund. But it occurred to me that, Jaguar Land Rover is this aspirational luxury brand, right? So, I mean, I grew up in Maryland. And as a kid, I still remember the first time I saw my first Jaguar. A friend of mine's father who was a successful attorney, rolled up in one to bring the two of us to basketball practice. And walking into that car, I felt like, you know, I felt like $1 million. So, you know, I think it has that, it has that effect on everybody. It's got that kind of brand. But when we look at the future of autonomous vehicles, you know, many are pointing out that AVs are going to be less about individual car ownership and more about fleets. And then, you know, people having some type of fleet membership or, you know, transportation card or something, and maybe not owning cars anymore. And so, you know, how do premium car companies look at the future? If automobiles and automobile companies become transportation as a service company, what are the opportunities for luxury car makers? What does that future of premium mobility look like? You know, things like premium design and engineering, what is that in the next era of transportation? Love to hear your thoughts on that. I know companies like Volvo have talked about, you know, these sleep cabins they're designing, and IKEA now is launching or talking about their spaces on wheels. So there's lots of different things kind of cropping up right now as it relates to transportation as a service. And so where does the premium car company live in this new world?
Also, if we strip it back to its essential parts, I think what premium means really comes down to the point you made a few seconds ago when you said you go up to that premium car and it makes you feel special and it makes you feel like the process of getting into that car is this amazing experience, right? There's something different about it, even if you can't put your finger on it. And I guess when we're investing in companies that we consider to be providing premium mobility services, we're looking for that same sense, that same thing. What is it that makes you special and ultimately makes you willing to pay a premium to consume that service? Now, for us, the paradigm shift we see is that, you know, that transitions from maybe the design of the physical product, although I think there's always an element of importance in that. Physical products offer really great opportunities for differentiation. And if you look at companies like Apple or Jaguar or Sonos, for instance, they're all great examples of that. But then it's also about differentiation on service, differentiation on customer service and the responsiveness of the company and how you talk and engage with the company. And that then becomes portfolio and look at how some of our companies are delivering what we consider premium services. I think we see some great examples. So there's one company in our portfolio called Shepherd. Shepherd offer children's transportation, family transportation. And I can't think of an area where it's more important to offer differentiation and a really kind of premium offering. So Shepherd take all of the same technologies that made Uber possible, like ubiquitous GPS in the palm of your hand and your smartphone, and the ability to pay in a second for an on-demand ride. And then they apply those technologies and those what technology enables to children's transportation, focusing really on two key things, which is trust and reliability. So in terms of trust, if you're a parent and your child is taking a ride in a Shepherd vehicle, at every single point along the way, you can see where your child is, who they're with, and how they're being taken care of. So when they get picked up at school, you can see that the teacher has handed them off to the driver. You can see who the driver is. And in Shepherd's case, you can even see that the driver took a breathalyzer test at the beginning of the shift and that they passed that test so that you know that they're sober and that they're safe and that they're taking care of your kid. And then you'll see the other children in the car that they're riding with. You'll see when those children are dropped off at their location. And then when they're handed back either to you or maybe to a nanny or at a children's activity, you'll see that happens. You see what we call the kind of chain of custody throughout the whole process. And what we've seen is that in Shepherd's case, that care, that craft, and that creation of an end-to-end service that meets all of the needs of its end user and goes above and beyond, for us, that's premium mobility. That's something that people are prepared to pay for, and it's an experience that people love and come back to time and time again.
Okay, great. You know, I guess our parents put us on school buses and trusted the school bus driver to drive, you know, 60, 70 kids who were screaming and jumping out of their seats. So it sounds like Shepherd's a little safer than that. And that segues perfectly into kind of the last question I wanted to get into with you, James. And that's, you know, just looking at your portfolio a bit. So You know, you're invested in autonomous fleet companies, specialized voice recognition, transportation rewards companies, data analytics and capture. We just mentioned the kids carpooling app, ride sharing you're doing. What are you most excited about as we look at the future of transportation? And more precisely, in an autonomous future, what are the features and services that we should be really excited about that might be at this point somewhat of an underreported story?
Okay, so I'm gonna give two different examples. One that relates to a deal which I can't talk about, but we'll announce in the next couple of weeks, and one that relates to a portfolio company that we invested in a year or so ago. So one area I'm super excited about is the concept of exclusive cities in the context of autonomy. So what does that mean? We've got a company in our portfolio called Voyage. They're an autonomous vehicle company. And they're operating fleets of autonomous vehicles in environments that people tend to call closed communities or exclusive cities is another word. Their first deployment is in 175,000 resident retirement community in Florida with hundreds of miles of road and four or five, I think, distinct downtown areas called the Villages, Florida. So this is a huge physically, huge in terms of population and huge in terms of complexity environment at city scale, where Voyage are able to operate a fleet, but really crucially removing some of the complexity of like a normal urban deployment of autonomous vehicles. So they have a single highways agency, which is the Villages and the property company that owns the Villages. They have a single owner and controller of the infrastructure, a single transport operator to deal with. And I think that as a model for rolling out autonomy in a very true sense, so not faking it, not cheating, but real autonomous vehicles without safety drivers providing safe, reliable services to real customers and every day is just an amazing go-to-market strategy and something that we see Voyage and a few others executing on really, really well. So I think that's a really exciting development. And I think one of the interesting questions in some other new areas like micro mobility is particularly when we look at tier two cities that aren't the huge mega cities like London and New York, particularly when we look at tier two cities, will they start to contract individual companies that they trust to operate a mobility service under license for the city in an exclusive way?
So the city of Austin, Texas tried something like that. And then I do believe Uber's back and Lyft is back into Austin. But I think Austin tried that. Am I right about that?
Maybe. I don't have that specific example too well.
Okay.
But I think we're going to see some really interesting relationships built between either private communities or perhaps tier two cities and autonomous vehicle operators. And I think the great thing about the market we're investing in is it's an absolutely huge commercial opportunity. And when you add up those opportunities across even the United States, there's billions on the table and there's some really important businesses to be built. And I think they can genuinely be distinct from the kind of Waymos and the Cruises of the world. So I think that's one area we're excited by. And then a second area, and we're closing a deal in the space, or we closed the deal in the space a couple of weeks ago, is what this question of what is going to be the top aggregation layer or the top layer of booking around transportation in the future. So we're seeing something really interesting happening right now. So Lyft and Uber, so Lyft are an InMotion portfolio company, are vertically integrating. So they're bringing bikes, scooters, as well as ride hailing into that platform. They're even allowing you to book public transport tickets through their application. And they're really trying to put their arms around as much of urban transportation as possible so that you can essentially live your entire transportation life within the Lyft or the Uber app. And that makes complete sense. And it's about increasing share of wallet. And once you've acquired a customer, really generating value from them, but also generating maximum value for them as well. But I think one area we're really interested in is that the more services you see rolled out in cities, and the more we increasingly become incredibly global in our outlook, and you know, we travel to multiple cities within our country and multiple cities internationally, will we see a new aggregation layer? Like we saw in travel with Metasearch, with groups like Expedia and Priceline. And I think our view is that there are billion-dollar companies to be built in the space of aggregating ground transportation, but that what you need to do is much more than what you've had to do in travel. You can't just surface the options that happen to be there at a given point in time. You need to do more. You need to show people how they can navigate in a multimodal way. You need to enable people to subscribe for transport passes, regardless of which form of transportation they might take. And you need to provide a really great user experience of at that really top layer of booking ground transportation. And I think when we introduce autonomy into the mix, that becomes even more interesting. So watch this space. We'll be announcing a really exciting new deal in that space in the next couple of weeks.
Fantastic. So that's almost breaking news. You know, you're kind of titillating, I guess, our listeners and letting them know that we'll be seeing some major news coming out of InMotion Ventures in the next few weeks. So thank you for that. And in general, James, thank you for coming on the podcast, and your insights and analysis were super instructive and super helpful. And so I appreciate that. I know our listeners appreciate that. Are you planning on being at any conferences if people want to kind of meet you or listen to you on a panel? Or are you going to be in any mobility conferences in the next few months?
Yes. So I know that in next week alone, so Tuesday, Wednesday of next week, which is 30th, 31st of October, I'm at the NOAA conference in London, and then speaking at the Intelligent Transport Conference in London on the 1st of November. And I'm at a Smart Cities conference in London the week after that. So we try and get around. We'll have people at South by Southwest and CES as well, our MDs at both of those conferences.
Fantastic. All right. Well, James, thanks so much. And look forward to meeting you in person, I hope, in the near future.
Yeah, absolutely. Have a good one.
And another episode of Raising Your Antenna is in the books. I hope you enjoyed today's episode and look forward to connecting again next week. Raising Your Antenna is a weekly podcast hosted by yours truly, Keith Zackheim, that features the movers and shakers and key influencers of the B2B technology industry. Our guests are leading revolutions and disruptions in the mobility, clean energy, healthcare, and real estate technology industries. Raising Your Antenna is brought to you by Antenna Group, a full-service digital marketing and public relations agency that focuses on the B2B technology industry. Please be in touch with me on Twitter at @CZackheim with any feedback about this podcast. And check out Antenna Group at www.antennagroup.com if your organization is looking for a really smart and good-looking marketing and public relations partner.